This is VOA News. By remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. More than 648,000 people have now died globally from COVID-19. That figure is more than 147,000 in the United States, exceeds 87,000 in Brazil. The number of infections globally exceeds 16.2 million, 4.2 million in the U.S., and 2.4 million in Brazil. The only other country that has more than a million confirmed infections is India, which has about 1.4 million confirmed infections. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says a new coronavirus economic aid package being unveiled Monday would pay the country's 16 million unemployed workers 70% of their one-time salaries. But tough negotiations lie ahead with opposition Democrats over the scope of more assistance to offset the severe economic effects of the pandemic. On Fox News Sunday, Mnuchin called the 70% wage replacement figure a very fair level. But that figure, if adopted by Congress, would sharply cut federal benefits to the unemployed by two-thirds. One mid-May report said that a fifth of the unemployed workers declined requests from their employers that they return to work because their wages were left and lower than what they were collecting in jobless benefits. Democratic lawmakers are demanding that the $600 a week boost in payments to the jobless workers be kept in place through the end of 2020. They're pushing for an overall coronavirus aid package totaling $3 trillion. Responding to upgraded travel alerts issued by Britain to its citizens visiting Spain, Spain's foreign minister says her country is safe for tourists. Speaking to reporters, Arantxa Gonzalez-Laya rebuked Britain for imposing a two-week quarantine on all travelers entering the country from Spain after a rise in its coronavirus numbers. This is VOA News. Hurricane Hanna's trail of devastation on the South Texas coast Sunday has been marked by overturned tractor trailers, power lines, and roofless homes with flash flooding, a threat to areas heavily impacted by COVID-19 infections. Hanna, the first storm of the hurricane season, came ashore as a Category 1 hurricane that continues to lose power and is now a tropical depression. And Hawaii, Maui's island's mayor, says that he is thankful that Hurricane Douglas did not cause any major damage as it bore down, packing torrential rains and damaging winds as it churned just east of the islands in the central Pacific. The Hawaiian islands are still expected to experience large swells Monday, producing life-threatening and potentially destructive surf along shores. Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok announced that forces are being stationed to the Darfur region, known for its tribal violence. The decision comes after an increase in deadly violence between Arab nomadic tribes and African farming tribes. At least 20 people were killed Friday in South Darfur by gunmen as they returned to their fields after an absence of more than 15 years, according to a local chief. Those killed Friday had been allowed to return to their land under an agreement reached 2 months ago with those who settled there during the conflict in Darfur. The conflict, which erupted in 2003 between the predominantly Arab region, or I should say the regime of Omar al-Bashir, and insurgents from ethnic minorities who consider themselves marginalized, has led to hundreds of thousands of deaths and millions of displaced, according to the UN. In recent years, it has waned in intensity. And in 2019, Bashir was overthrown by the army under pressure from street protests. The new government, resulting from an agreement between the military and leaders of the protest, began talks in October of 2019 for a peace agreement with rebel groups and put an end to the conflicts in the region. Malaysian officials say 24 Rohingya migrants are feared to have drowned off a Malaysian resort island near Thailand. Malaysian authorities launched a search and rescue operation on Sunday for the Rohingya refugees who disappeared after jumping into the water from a boat and attempted to swim to the island of Langkaw. Malaysia's Coast Guard said 25 people had tried to swim to shore late Saturday, but only one of them made it to the island. Muslim-majority Malaysia is a favored destination for Rohingya Muslims seeking a better life after escaping a 2017 military crackdown in their mostly Buddhist homeland of Myanmar and since then living in refugee camps in Bangladesh. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For the next 2 weeks, I'll be filling in for James Butte. Today is Monday, July 27th, and we have a great show for you lined up, so do not reduce the volume. Here are the stories we are covering. A wave of attacks in Sudan's Darfur region leaves dozens dead.
And the main problem is no one of those who commit crime, no one of them is brought to justice.
That was journalist Ezzeldin Arbab in Omdurman, Sudan. Also ahead, the latest in Mali's political crisis. Somalia's prime minister is ousted, while Tunisia may have a new prime minister. A prominent South Sudanese dissident accuses President Salva Kiir of trying to kill him. And Kenya considers banning alcohol sales in bars and restaurants.
So I think it is crucial that if we are going to stay in this condition, we adhere strictly to what public health experts are saying.
That was Dr. Bernard Mwia in Nairobi, Kenya. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Our top story today is in Sudan, where more than 60 people were reported killed and nearly 60 others wounded during an armed attack in a village in the restive Darfur region on Saturday. The United Nations said late Sunday that the attack in Masteri village in West Darfur state was one of the latest in a string of security incidents in Darfur. Sudan's state media said Sunday that the government would deploy joint forces from various state security services in Darfur after the violence. Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok told a delegation of Darfuri women that the force would, quote, protect people and secure the agriculture season, end quote. The state media said three people, including a woman, were killed during a renewed dispute between farmers and shepherds in the Al-Jarf area in North Darfur state on Sunday. In a separate incident, at least 20 people died and 22 others were injured after a militia attacked a village in the state of South Darfur, witnesses and community leaders told news agencies Saturday. The AFP news agency said the victims were farmers returning to their fields after being driven away years ago, and some of the dead were children. For more on this latest wave of violence in Darfur, I spoke with journalist Ezzeldin Arbab in Omdurman, Sudan.
Generally, there is a big increase in crimes in Darfur. We yearly see an increase in the farming season in Darfur and dispute between tribes and farmers and so on. But this year, so far has seen the biggest increase in this year in crimes. There are multiple attacks in Darfur in the past week, in West Darfur, in Misri, and the second one is in South Darfur in a village called Abu Dos. And also there is an attack in Kutum, Foto Borno, and Kapkabia. So this is a huge increase in killing.
Now, Darfur has been in conflict for almost two decades, but of course, Sudan has gone through a major political shift, now has a new civilian prime minister after former President Omar al-Bashir was overthrown last year. Yet still, these attacks are happening in Darfur.
People of Darfur participated in the sit-in which took Bashir down. And when they changed the regime, they dreamed of security and so on. But now what I see is very different from their dreams. Because the first thing they wanted after the Bashir's fall down is the security. And now the security is just going down. And the main problem is no one of those who commit crime, no one of them is brought to justice.
That was journalist Ezzeldin Arbab in Omdurman, Sudan. Mali's political crisis continues after five West African leaders visited Bamako last week to try to break the impasse. Opposition groups calling themselves M5, led by the charismatic Imam Mahmoud Diko, have staged mass protests in recent months in the capital Bamako, with many calling for the president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, to step down amid worsening insecurity and accusations of corruption and nepotism. Keita has been president for 7 years after being re-elected elected to a second five-year term 2 years ago. VOA's Modibo Dembele reports from Bamako that on Monday, the five West African heads of state will consult with other leaders from the Economic Community of West African States on a way forward for Mali.
The West African leaders are supposed to have an extraordinary meeting. The five leaders that were deployed in Mali will be discussing with the rest of the West African leaders. It will be through a video conference, and based on what we hear, they told them clearly they are not allowed to force, according to ECOWAS protocol, a president to resign. One of the leaders of the M5, his name is Mr. Bachili, who is a lawyer. He said at the same time, Malians also are not forced to keep a president who has failed within 10 years after spending 7 years of mismanagement to keep that president for the remaining of that 3 years.
So what are the M5's latest demands?
The M5 is still asking the resignation of the president of Mali. However, there is some kind of discrepancy between members of the M5. People like Mahmoud Diko, who is the imam and one of the moral authority within the M5, is okay if the president is willing to get rid of the National Assembly and also the Constitutional Court, which is really dumb. It will be fine for him that the president stay. However, we have also other side, those folks such as General Moussa Cinco and Sheikh Oumar Sissoko are clearly asking the resignation of the president of Mali because they say they can no longer accept corruption, nepotism, according to them, were the result of his management.
Now, the president already dissolves the Constitutional Court earlier this month. Is there a possibility that he'll do the same for the National Assembly?
But here, there is a lot of issues or obstacles. The acting or the current president of the National Assembly is part of the ruling party. And also the son of the president of Mali, Mr. Karim Keita, also is a member of the parliament. So according to some analysts, they doubt that the president will really be okay to dissolve the National Assembly and also organize partial or even full election across the country. So this situation is really creating a dilemma. And right now, the question is the president is gonna also being obliged to dissolve the National Assembly? And if the president does this, will the M5 accept any kind of offer from the government?
On a way forward for Mali. That was VOA's Modibo Dembele speaking to me from Bamako, Mali. The United States and the European Union expressed disappointment with the removal from office of Somali Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre on Saturday. They said his ouster is a setback to progress and reforms in Somalia. Khayre lost a no-confidence vote at the parliament after he told his cabinet that the country should hold elections without extensions. Some Somali political observers have said the process to remove the prime minister was illegal. Harun Maruf of VOA Somali Service spoke to former Somali Prime Minister Omar Abdelrashid Sharmake about the new political developments in Mogadishu.
My take is that actually the parliament did not respect its own bylaws, which is that I think a group of parliamentarians should submit a motion against the government and the prime minister before actually taking into consideration the second of the other vote for the confidence or no confidence in for the government. I think that was a kind of unfortunate thing. In the parliament, maybe had the kind of enough votes to sack the government, but the procedure in which they have freely chosen was not the procedure that is in line with its own bylaws, the bylaws of the parliament itself.
Why do you think the prime minister was removed?
I think the main reason is, although kind of the accusations stated in that kind of a vote, which is the government did not completed the key issues that was part of the program of the government, which was completion of the constitution and election one person, one vote in the states of the capital. And although that was kind of a valid point. Nonetheless, I think it's a political issue at this juncture that actually the Prime Minister was removed because of not having, not being in line politically with both the President and the Parliament.
Where do you think Somalia goes from here?
I think this is the question that is actually most important and concerns actually the Somali society. I think it's crucial that now in the appointment of the next Prime Minister is held on based on broader kind of a consultation in on what is going, and specified exactly what are going to be the kind of a, in the powers in which this Prime Minister will have to really kind of a, in chart the way out of this in the stalemate, political stalemate in the country. I think there's one side, the state, regional states that have kind of in issue a communique in which elections should happen on time. And there's a parliament that actually is moving forward with one person, one vote, regardless of how long it will take, kind of a year or 2 years. So if these two points are not negotiated on time, I think the country is headed into a very disastrous kind of end.
That was former Somali Prime Minister Omar Abdirashid Sharmake speaking to my VOA Somali Service colleague, Haroon Marouf. Tunisian President Kais Saied on Saturday designated the Interior Minister as the new Prime Minister after the previous Prime Minister resigned over allegations of a conflict of interest. New Premier Hesham Meshishi, 46 and independent, now has a month to form a government capable of winning a confidence vote in Parliament by a simple majority, or the president will dissolve Parliament and call for another election with urgent economic decisions hanging over the North African nation. For more, I spoke to Dr. Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Middle East program of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
The new prime minister designate, and I think we have to be careful because this guy will be the third one to have tried to form a government since the elections in October. So there's no guarantee he will even become prime minister. But he is someone who, frankly, is not incredibly well known to the Tunisian public or to the international community. He is currently serving or was currently serving as the Minister of Interior under President Kais Saied, who appointed him. But really, the most important thing is that he is President Saied's advisor. He's someone who President Saied trusts. He's one of his legal advisors. He served in a couple of different positions during the previous government, such as in the Ministry of Transport and Ministry of Social Affairs. But he's mostly known for being an advisor to the president.
So why do you think the president chose him?
It's showing that President Saied really wants to have more of a hands-on role in parliament. His previous, the person he selected, Elias Fakhfakh, was also his choice. Saied was pretty much hands-off. But what you're seeing is him appointing one of his actual advisors, someone who he has a really close relationship to. I think this is a signal that we're going to see the president get much more involved in the affairs of parliament, and I'm not sure what exactly that's going to mean for the future of Tunisia.
How might the opposition react?
So one of the things that's interesting is that he is not one of the candidates that any of the parties put forward. Each of the parties provided the president with a list of names of people they thought would be a good choice to be the prime minister designate. He was not one of them. So what we're likely to see is one of two scenarios. One is that the parties could all say, okay, look, he's a technocrat. He's not really representing any particular party. Maybe we can come to agreement around the fact that this guy isn't going to really hurt or help any of us, and so we can form a government, move forward. But the other scenario is that people are angry that, you know, particularly the parties who have more power in the parliament, such as Ennahda, as well as one of the other opposition parties called Tunis, others, what they could see is that this guy doesn't represent any of the parties and they want their own interests to be represented. I do think we are going to see a fairly bitter fight over what the next government looks like. They are very divided. They're more divided now than they even were 5 months ago when the previous head of government, Elias Fakhfakh, formed his coalition.
So there's a month for the prime minister designate to form a new government. What should we be looking for?
We should be watching just to see who are the names that are nominated for certain important positions, and then how the parliament sort of lines up. You know, what is the coalition going to look like? Will we see parties that were previously in the opposition be brought in, such as Kalb Tunis, or will we see Ennahda, the party that was in, be left out? And there's going to be a lot of this maneuvering that takes place. There's a month for the government to form and for parliament to agree. And if that doesn't happen, there is a possibility of new elections, which are something that would be really difficult to do, particularly in the during the COVID-19 pandemic.
That was Dr. Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Middle East Program of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Prominent South Sudanese activist Peter Biar Ajak, who is the founder of the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, accuses the country's president, Salva Kiir, of ordering a hit squad to kill him in Nairobi, Kenya, where he was staying with his family. Ajak has since fled to the United States. VOA's Ayan Bior has more.
In July 2018, South Sudanese dissident Peter Biar Ajak was jailed in one of South Sudan's most notorious prisons, called the Blue House. At first, Ajak wasn't charged, and many saw his arrest as political. A court later convicted Ajak of disturbing the peace following a prisoner uprising within the Blue House. This January, South Sudan's president Salva Kiir pardoned Ajak after he spent a year and a half behind bars. But during an online news conference Friday, Biar said last month Kiir sent forces to spy on him and kill him in Nairobi, where he was living with his family. South Sudan's government stands accused of disappearing two other South Sudanese dissidents in Kenya in 2016. The government denies all the accusations. Ajak said he began to feel unsafe in Nairobi after South Sudanese forces killed a fellow pardoned Blue House prisoner in June. That man, named Kerbino Wool, had rebelled against Kiir's government a few months after being released from prison. South Sudan's government claims they killed Kerbino in combat.
Immediately when Kerbino announced that he has formed rebellion, South Sudan government, particularly the National Security and the Office of the President, began to make up allegations that I had something to do with the activities of this gentleman. And then, 9 days later on, Kerbino was captured by the government forces, national security forces specifically, and then he was executed.
Now, Ajak is in Washington, D.C. He arrived in the United States last Thursday after the U.S. State Department granted him and his family what his lawyer described as emergency visas. His lawyer said such visas are given out on rare occasions when people's lives are in imminent danger and when rescuing the person is in Washington's interest. 36-year-old Biar says he wants a generational exit of South Sudan's current leadership. He also called for sanctions against South Sudanese officials who he accuses of carrying out human rights violations.
U.S. has already done this with the number of people that were involved in the kidnapping of the two critics from Nairobi. And they have also sanctioned a lot of people in South Sudan so far who have been basically thwarting peace and efforts to reconciliation in the country. Now, I feel like some of these people that are sanctioned don't actually have the power to bring about the kind of change that is required in the country. And the people that are ultimately responsible for these violations, President Kiir himself and his head of national security, General Kolkur Kuch, so far they have not been sanctioned. Although we know that it was national security that kidnapped those two critics from Nairobi and ultimately killed them. And he's the head of national security. So he's basically the guy that implements all these violations.
Biar is a graduate of Harvard University in Massachusetts and a trained economist. Ayan Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Kenya's Bars, Hotels, and Liquor Traders Association has protested a Ministry of Health proposal to ban alcohol sales in restaurants and bars. The health ministry proposed the measure to limit the spread of COVID-19. Journalist Maureen Ojiambo has the story from Nairobi.
On 6th of this month, when President Uhuru Kenyatta was partially reopening Kenya's economy, he directed bar, hotels, and liquor traders to operate as takeaways and not sit on. A few days later, the Ministry of Health said that many restaurants operators had turned their premises into bars against the ministry's protocols as many risk closure, protesting the new guidelines that might be implemented soon that will see closure of many restaurants across the country. Secretary General Bar Owners Association Boniface Gachoka said that those violating the guidelines should be punished individually and that the closure risks loss of millions of jobs. across the country.
If the proposals are approved about the closure, that means the only place where alcohol will be consumed is in people's homes, which is against the spirit of Alcoholics Drink Control Act. Should the new proposals be implemented, a lot of Kenyans will be rendered jobless. We're talking of 1.8 million Kenyans. We ask the president and the summit of governors scheduled for Monday to make a prudent decision that would balance the need to keep the economy alive and good livelihood of Kenyans.
The association is also concerned about what they term as illegal declaration by county government officials and policemen who are banning the sale of alcohol, as this would result in intimidation and exhaustion. Mungai Kagiri, chairman Liquor Trade Association Kiambu County, said that the government should hold talks with the association before implementing the guidelines that will negatively impact bar, hotels and liquor traders.
We need that the policymakers start looking at this industry holistically. What we are urging is that we are ready to sit down, we talk, but we talk as we are trading. We should not talk when we are not trading. Once you close the legal avenues of getting the legalized drinks, you open the floodgates for counterfeits and illegal drinks to thrive.
However, the public health experts warn that COVID-19 cannot be contained when entertainment joints are operational. Public health expert officer Dr. Bernard Mwia said that the entertainment joints cannot adhere to Kenya's Ministry of Health guidelines of keeping distance and wearing masks, as most of the people will be drinking and eating. Today, Monday, President Uhuru Kenyatta is set to hold an extraordinary summit with the Council of Governors to address the level of preparedness of the 47 counties in containing the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
It's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jason. We begin the sports with the English Premier League, one of the most followed leagues on the African continent, which came to a close on Sunday. Manchester United and Chelsea sealed UEFA Champions League places as Bournemouth and Watford fell through the trapdoor on a dramatic final day of the longest Premier League season. Liverpool were crowned champions last month, and two of Africa's most prolific players, Sadio Mane of Senegal and Mo Salah of Egypt, played a pivotal role in their title-winning campaign. Liverpool's Mohamed Salah was the fifth highest goal scorer in the league this season with 19 goals. World football governing body FIFA has handed a 10-year ban to Guinea-Bissau Football Association President Manuel Nascimento over an incident of mob justice. Nascimento, who was set to defend his seat on Saturday in an election, was also hit with a $108,000 fine by judges at FIFA's Independent Ethics Committee. And now to Uganda, where Ugandan boxers are looking ahead to the lifting of the COVID-19 lockdown on sport activities to begin preparations for their participation in the inaugural AIBA Global Boxing Cup, due to take place between November and December 2020 in Russia. One of the boxers expressed concern over the impact of COVID-19 on their training ahead of the Global Boxing Cup.
We wouldn't want to be the only country that misses in this Global Cup, because it's going to be the first of its kind, and God knows we'll become the world's champion, because boxing has always been doing wonders for the country.
Meanwhile, president of the local Ugandan basketball governing body, FUBA, Nasri Serengoji, says the decision to cancel all its 2020 basketball activities except for the AfroBasket qualifiers was the last and best option. FUBA took the decision after President Yoweri Museveni failed to give any indication as to when sports will come out of lockdown in his latest COVID-19 update.
Even if they were to open up, they are not going to open up at once. They are going to do it in a phased manner, that they would start with a low risk sports like golf, tennis, table tennis, lawn tennis. Then they will give it some time to monitor and see the effects. And then after that, they move on to the medium risk. After that, they move on to the high risk.
In cricket news, three members of South Africa women's cricket squad have tested positive for COVID-19 right before their training camp for a proposed England tour. The training camp is scheduled to start from the 27th of July in the Rainbow Nation. That's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jason, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. We look forward to your next report on Friday. That's it for this Monday, July 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of Managing Editor James Butsey, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington.